this is a spoiler.
You can't listen to this and not have spoilers.
We're doing Death in Venice.
Yes, we are.
I didn't prepare a summary for this because I just felt I could wing it. so here it goes. Death in Venice. It's about a aging writer. I believe he's 53 years old, named Gustav Aschenbach, and he decides to go on a vacation, which takes him first to some town in Italy, but because he doesn't like it there, he eventually moves on to Venice. And when he gets to Venice, the weather's also not very nice. Eventually he sees on the beach a 14-year-old Polish boy. We find out later his name is Tadziu, and he's described as incredibly beautiful, and it starts a almost platonic dialogue within Aschenbach's head. But despite having seen him, he decides the weather and conditions of Venice aren't right for him and decides to leave. But just as he's leaving, he questions his decision. He wishes to stay. He catches Tadju's eye, and luckily his luggage is shipped somewhere else, and he decides to stay in his hotel while it's being sorted out. And he spends his time sitting on the beach looking at Tadziu, writing his book or writing essays that are inspired by looking at Tadziu. His luggage comes back, but he still decides to stay. He gets more and more attached to Tadziu, and as that happens, a strange phenomenon's going around Venice. People are being hush-hush, and it turns out later that there is a cholera epidemic in Venice that the locals aren't telling any foreigners about. At this point, Gustav knows about the epidemic, and instead of telling Tadziu and his family to get out, he thinks that he wouldn't be able to deal with them leaving, so he also doesn't tell the family about the cholera epidemic. This leads him one day to finally follow them through the narrow streets of Venice, where he loses them. He eats an overripe strawberry that eventually leads him to recline in his beach chair looking at Tadziu and dying. And that is the story.
Excellent.
Yeah, I was surprised by how much it swung on this. I mean, we were talking about it just a second before. This creepy love? I mean, it's creepy? Or, that's the line I was towing. I didn't know if it was... I mean, obviously he's infatuated with this boy. I didn't realize that he was 14. I thought that he was much younger, and it was almost like a child. He was fascinated with a childlike youth, but 14, yeah, that does change it a bit. I mean, because he's described running around on the beach, like playing in the sand, with some other boys.
Simpler times, darling.
Yeah, that's what it really must be. I mean, it hinges on this, basically. I mean, this shock of this boy's beauty, basically.
So I thought I got through the beginning, and then I started reading, and I got an idea, and then I started reading through it, and I kind of kept it in my head the whole time. I think that when he went to the... Like, it opens with his death. I mean, he goes to a funeral home, and there are all the headstones. He sees someone he has a kind of strange attraction to. I think it's death. And I think that everything that follows is, I mean, I think that Tadziu is him as a child. He's like, he left behind his youth to become it talks about his sense of responsibility all the time. And so I just kind of read it that way, that this is him going over his life and basically mourning what he lost, and also having this tremendous attraction to the carefree time in his life, and realizing what he had missed by being so responsible, and also the idea that he didn't allow his art to flourish in a way that it might have had he not been so strict about his process.
Yeah, because he was certainly successful.
Yeah.
I mean, he's known, as far as I know, fictional book. The abject doesn't really exist, or it's not referring to something.
Right, but he also wrote the story of Frederick the Great.
That's right. Yes, those are two different things.
So, that's right. Yeah, so there was that.
And it's just that he's a successful guy, you know, it's not, it's not that he, I mean, eminently successful in his field.
He's successful, but I think the big thing was respect, right? That he is well respected. He wants to be well thought of. Yeah.
I mean, he was knighted. I should have said he's Gustav von Auschenbach.
Right.
And also, I think his books, I think it was described, he took out every superfluous word, and they were even taught in schools at this point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that was just the way that I colored it while I was reading it. That, you know, doesn't really have any effect on what's said and on what he's, you know what I mean? Like, still the ideas are still the same, but it just kind of struck me that, oh, okay, maybe I'll read this, you know, like Jacob's Ladder.
I didn't get the him being the child, which is an interesting take, but you're right that it's very, what's the word, reflexive. The title is Death in Venice. It starts in a cemetery with, it ends there. I mean, he goes, I mean, the gondola ride is also very reminiscent.
Yeah, he talks about it being a coffin. And the child is sickly. I thought that was the thing that really said, oh, okay, he's looking at himself. He isolated himself. And this little boy is isolated from his family, and he also stands apart from the other children. And, you know, it's when he looks back over his shoulder at him that he dies. It's not like, oh, he gave him such a coquettish glance that he, you know, gave him a heart attack. It was just like, okay, that's it.
Well, it seems like there's this symmetry too between the creeping epidemic in Venice and the sort of corruption going on within him.
Yeah, you're right. I didn't mention that during his sojourn to Venice, he sees a bunch of rowdy young sailors getting drunk, and he sees one person stand out of the crowd, and on closer inspection, it's a scene like an old man with dyed hair, dyed wig, makeup on, and it gives him a feeling of disgust. And of course, at the end of the book, he ends up becoming that man. He gets his hair dyed. He gets makeup
on. Yeah, he gets his hair dyed.
Yeah, that's a huge part of the book is this contrasting between age and youth and what is supposed to belong to each particular category. You get this sense that there's that theme of the imposter that you see sort of embodied in that guy who's pretending, who's got the dentures and the makeup and the dyed hair that Auschenbach eventually becomes, and sort of question to me whether what kind of desires are permissible in an aged man, you know, and then what permissibility even has to do with desire.
Yeah, I was just listening to this. I mean, you're right. He does come full around on this because, you know, he goes and gets his hair dyed by the barber and allows himself to be made up. And it only hit me at the very end that was connected to that guy that he saw and was disgusted with on the ferry over or whatever. But I was just going to say that reminded me of the Fresh Air interview with Leonard Cohen, and he was talking about desire and how it's not that the desire goes away, but you're just not wanted anymore, basically.
Like, that's right. I remember listening to that, and he said, like you're saying, he said, there comes a point when you just can't talk about it anymore because it's inappropriate, but that doesn't mean it's not there.
I just wanted to mention, I mean, it's all tied up in this idea of beauty, and I mean, his opinion on Taju's beauty was that it's aristocratic. And I mean, I think he specifically uses the term unfair, but in a way, what he's doing in trying to reclaim that beauty, reclaim his youth, is, you know, trying to transgress against this unfair system. But of course, it doesn't work. He becomes hideous.
There's a section I want to read here because the thing that struck me as I was reading it was the idea of beauty separate from lust, like the beauty of a great Greek statue and the Greek myth that's brought into this story. But it just, I kept going back and forth. Is this creepy or is this something not more royal, more sensitive, a beauty that is not creepy?
It's awe-inspiring. I think, you know, sometimes there's, you know, that kind of beauty that is just...
Right, but observing it, appreciating it, loving it in a way that's not lust. I mean, that's...
I had a friend who was so beautiful, this guy who was so beautiful. I used to think, he's like a flower. I mean, you can't really, you know, or like a butterfly. If you touch those wings, like, he won't be able to fly. You don't go there with him. He's too pretty for that.
That's what I kept going back and forth on. It's like, what is this beauty? Because it seemed to me so initially, like Daniel said at the beginning, so amazingly creepy to see this older man running through the streets of Venice after this 13, 14-year-old child. And I kept thinking there's got to be something grander to this. But anyway, I just want to read this section here. but on the grass, which sloped down gently so that one could hold up one's head as one lay, there reclined two men, sheltered here from the heat of the noonday, one elderly and one young, one ugly and one beautiful, the wise beside the desirable. And Socrates, wooing him with witty compliments and jests, was instructing Phaedrus on desire and virtue. He spoke to him of the burning tremor of fear which the lover will suffer when his eye perceives a likeness of eternal beauty, spoke to him of the lusts of the profane and base who cannot turn their eyes to beauty when they behold its image and are not capable of reverence, spoke of the sacred terror that visits the noble soul when a godlike countenance, a perfect body, appears to him, of how he trembles then and is beside himself and hardly dares look at the possessor of beauty and reveres him and would even sacrifice to him as to a graven image if he did not fear to seem foolish in the eyes of men. For beauty, dear Phaedrus, only beauty is at one and the same time divinely desirable and visible. It is, mark well, the only form of the spiritual that we can receive and endure with our senses. For what would become of us if other divine things, if reason and virtue and truth, were to appear to us sensuously? Should we not perish in a conflagration of love, as once upon a time Semel did before Zeus' path to the spirit? Only the path, only a means, little Phaedrus. See, I kept going back and forth, and I really wanted this character to be better than my gut kept thinking he was. And then I kept thinking about what Socrates was talking about in terms of that kind of beauty that you can perceive and be in the presence of or not be in the presence of because it's so reverent. And I kept thinking, is that what's going on here? Or is this fucking disgustingly creepy stuff? And it was really freaking me out, aside from the fact that I read that this is based on a true story, that Thomas Mann actually did see this kid. I sent you those pictures, right, that I came across of the guy that this kid is based on, Taddeo is based on, lived and existed and died in 1986.
He died in 1986.
What? This guy, Taddeo, actually, the man that, or the kid that he's actually based on, died in 1986. My point is, well, wait a minute, what's going on here? Because a lot is going on in this book, a lot about Nietzsche, Apollo, and Dionysus, birth of tragedy. So there's a lot going on in this story. But I kept coming back to him. I was like, are we not able to observe and be a part of that kind, or see our lives without lust coming into it, without this debasement coming into it? I'm asking today, us today, or anybody ever.
I thought also, I mean, I love that Socrates section. And I don't think that there always has to be a debasement. And I also don't think that having sexual desire for something is necessarily a debasement. I mean, maybe if it's, you know, pedophilia, then it is. But I don't feel like it has to be that way. So
no, I don't think it has to be that way. I'm just wondering. Right.
I think that what he was going through was the, you know, the how not black and white it is. You know, this was not, you know, Lolita. This is something different.
I was hoping it wasn't Lolita.
Yeah. I do think that it was awe. He's looking back over his life. I thought that it was more of awe, but it also, it's not that it never comes into it. All of art, all of beauty doesn't have to be in a museum, right? And nature brings up emotions that are very different.
Yeah. I mean, I got the sense that it was awe as well. I was just looking at a line, basically, with an outburst of rapture, he told himself that what he saw was beauty's very essence, form as divine thought, the single and pure for perfection, which resides in the mind, of which an image and likeness rare and holy was here raised up for adoration. And whenever he uses words like debauch and lust, it's not directed at Tazio. It's like of the exhaustion after a debauch. It's like a lover, but that's just, these are just kind of like parallel things with this feeling that he's having. And he's fully aware that he is being weird about it, you know, or doesn't want to get seen at the opera or on the beach or on the piazza, just walking around. But I did get the sense that he has just discovered something, and he's also looking for something new in this stage in his life, right? And he almost left it, you know, to find it elsewhere and had this be, but, you know, just a moment. So I think that, you know, he is searching for something, and he didn't know. He wasn't thinking that he was like going to go out and like find, he wasn't looking for that specifically. So I think that he was genuinely surprised and struck with awe. Yeah. I mean, people have stunned me before. This is like a pretty unique circumstance, and I'm not sure where he's coming from with his age and in his past, but it could have gone this weird, dark place. But I don't think that that it ever went there. And it just seemed to be that it was this...
It seemed to be running with that, to not use that word. But it seemed to be close to that at some point.
That's us hoping that it's not there and worrying there's going to be, you know, this moment of repulsion or whatever.
Yeah, I think that he worried that it was, that it would be seen that way. And I think that he worried, I mean, you know, maybe he worried that it was there within himself. But I, you know, I hear what both of you are saying. It is an odd thing to find a teenage boy on the beach and follow him around. The interesting part to me was that the you know, specter on the stairs at the funeral parlor in the beginning, he had been staring at, and that was what basically set him off on his journey, was that that discomfort with having stared too long at the specter on the stairs at the funeral home. There was that whole idea of manners and how we approach beauty, or even just looking at someone could be strange looking, some whatever, when you look at someone, which is, of course, becoming a dying art with cell phones.
Important to note, too, that like this isn't something, I mean, they were on the same boat together, right? Or was it a train? Anyway, it seemed like a train car. But anyway, like they were just strangers together. Then they happened to be in the same hotel together. He like slowly overheard people calling his name, and by spending time in the same place became acquainted, because that's just where they were. It's not as if he just turned around in the street and followed somebody back to their house.
No, but he did follow Tadzio and the family.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, he totally did.
The incriminating, I mean, to incriminate Gustav, he ends up eventually following them throughout town. And then at one point, I think he even stands outside his door and puts his ear to Tadzio's door.
Yeah, that's whenever I think he's deepest in the thrall. He said he was just mad with ecstasy at the thought of being so close to his object, I guess, of affection. And, you know, knew that it would look bad, but was almost unable to control. And I thought it was going to go that way. I thought it was going towards an encounter with the grandmother or whoever.
The governess,
yes, thank you.
But I'll tell you one thing that jumps out at me too is because I had read about how not only was this kind of based on a true story, because Mon was at the same hotel, the Hotel de la Ban or something, and saw a kid and he watched him throughout his whole vacation there. I think the issue of pedophilia, we are much more sensitive and freaked about than maybe they were in 1911 when Mon actually saw this kid.
Yeah.
You know, like maybe that's what us as readers are not aware of as we're reading this, but something is jumping out at us that we as readers today are feeling that maybe he wasn't feeling when he wrote this.
Sure. I think we can't, questioning the legitimacy of that relationship is not even something that's done today and should be done. The way I come to it, and where you mentioned the platonic dialogue about beauty, is this kind of reminded me of the same stance, the same intellectual stance Gustav kind of took, as reminded me of Raskolnikov took in Crime and Punishment, where he constructs this theory in his head. He's an intellectual man, and he thinks he can handle it, but it ends up unraveling his life. I mean, you know, he talks about this platonic beauty, how the lover is in fact more important than the lover, how you're not supposed to consummate this love. But in going through the story, he realized how in switching over to the sensual, in looking at the sensual object, it unravels the order that he's used to in his life. And almost necessarily so, it seems that you can't be this lover in the way he describes it in Socrates' terms without unraveling your life somewhat, because it's not an orderly experience.
Yeah, I want to piggyback on that, Cesare, because I think that there's this line that I have here, and this is, so I think that this moment, this kind of like maybe madness within himself is at this point in the story, contrasting with the increasing deaths on the street due to whatever, a cover-up, some kind of a plague, some kind of disease, you know, miasmas and vapors and all that stuff. But so there's this. His thoughts dwelt upon the image of the desolate and calamitous city, and he was giddy with fugitive, mad, unreasoning hopes and visions of a monstrous sweetness. That tender sentiment he had a moment ago evoked, what was it compared with such images as these? His art, his moral sense, what were they in the balance besides the boons that chaos might confer? He kept silent, he stopped on. So, I mean, he's flirting with what if everything goes away? What if I just lose like my whole view of art and my moral sense? And what if the other side of what if everybody in the city dies and I'm left alone here with this kid? You know, I think that was on the line at the time. Could, you know, what is possible now in the future?
what I hear is that you're getting at this question of the judgment of his desire and whether or not, how should we look at his desire, you know, as something. This is what's sort of great about this book. You mentioned Strangers a minute ago, and I sort of thought of Camus' novel because there's not a lot maybe similar between them. But one thing is that they both leave the reader with a lot to make his own mind up about. And I think that's sort of the thing that makes this book great, is that we're left to think about his desire and how it relates to desires we might have, and should we make judgments about these desires? Are they just there in this amoral kind of sense, or is this something to be repressed, or is this something that is even possible to repress? Is it a sin? Is it something?
Yeah, Stephen, I immediately caught on to that word desire at the beginning of your question, because my concern was, what's going on here, a desire or a recognition of this almost unspeakable beauty that he sees?
I think that desire has to be, I think that desire is a part of beauty, right? I mean, there's something that's, when you consider something beautiful, there is.
All right, the Mona Lisa.
Well, there is a tug at some sort, I'm not saying that it has to be sexual desire, but there is desire within it.
But doesn't desire mean that you somehow want to consume, but
I think you can have desire and not, you know, have to want to possess something. You can see beautiful things that you don't. Every once in a while, I become covetous of a piece of art. I'm there with it and I'm like, oh my God, if you came home with me, I would love you every day. Hang you on my wall and I would worship. You know, there is a desire in that, but there's also a desire in just in beauty. That is, I mean, what is it that tugs at our heart, but some form of desire when we see beauty? What is it? It's not just, I don't think that it's just a recognition. I think always goes further than that.
Well, like Laura, like you were saying, this is very intertextual with Plato's Phaedrus. And I think Mary's getting at the question in that dialogue too, about what the nature of this desire is. And it's, from what I understand for Plato, right, it's, you know, you're supposed to see, like Mary was saying, beyond the object of the desire to the form of beauty itself. And so you sort of intellectualize this desire until it becomes an appreciation of beauty and not the particular in which you're seeing the beauty. But one of the questions of the novel, I think, like Cesare was just saying, is, does it really actually work that way, you know, in these particular circumstances? Or are we built in such a way, or
I think
maybe
we do.
Sometimes we can't help it.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
In that case, an affection there, and maybe even a desire to be close with it, and maybe even a bit possessive and want to have those conversations. And that seems to me a corollary to what's going on here, because I was uncomfortable at the prospect of an older guy lusting after this young kid, but that wasn't there. That's just what I was worried about.
An older guy racing through the streets of Venice, wherever this kid and his family are going. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying, I'm looking for, I'm hoping for, I'm searching for, as I'm reading this story, that existence of beauty in a non-pedophilic, creepy, desire way. I want it to be more what Socrates is talking about.
Maybe it's that you have kids and you're the only one of us who has kids. No, I'm serious, because you get a lot of shit when you're a parent about, watch out for this, watch out for that, news at, you know, are your children being raped at school, news at 10, you know, that, like, all of those things that happen when you're, that come at you when you're a parent, and all of those, the natural worry that you have, and then the worry that we as a society have piled on top. So I feel like that might make it harder in this day and age to actually look at something like this and not see
or worry that I'm seeing. No, yeah, you're right, absolutely.
I don't know, there are things that there are objects of beauty that I seek out all the time. If I go to the beach all the time, stuff like that, you know, if I lived near where I saw a piece of artwork that I fell in love with, I would, you know, I would go as much as I could to be near it. So there's just, but I also felt like he was looking for his own sense of beauty, his own treatment of beauty, and the loss in becoming so responsible in the way that he had dealt with his art in such a meticulous, workaday manner, that he had lost something.
Yeah.
This kid basically, I thought it was him, but basically he made him realize he's chasing beauty. What he had been doing had been, yes, it was an art, but it was also a craft, and that he didn't let art in more. That was the sense that I got from it, that he was chasing himself as a young boy and wanting to possess the last time, because it said a few places, I think it said that when he was 14, he had to start on his great journey toward being this great writer.
And this was written into his life from very early on.
So I just thought that it was kind of like, oh, I want to go up and talk to him. I want to tell him, take this other path or whatever. Or I want to go and see when I still believed in beauty or something like that. I want to go find the beauty that was myself, that was in me then.
I think that's important. I'm hoping someone has these lines written down or memorized, because he actually talks about how he didn't have any talent as an artist, for instance. What his family provided him was this talent for perseverance and for continual work. And what his art, he described as his art and his clientele for his art as something along the lines of people who face adversity and are able to persevere, like a continual pushing back of this abyss. And in this experience of Tattoo, I think he changes his artistic stance at a categorical level. I don't want to use the word unravels, but he gives in to these impulses, and there is no order. There is no fighting back against anything. It's a sense of letting yourself go, which, I mean, for me is, I don't want to bring this up too early, but for me is highlighted in his dream at the end, is this, you know, Dionysian orgy, pretty much.
Right.
Rather than sternly facing the tides of life.
Yeah, you can sort of slot the order and the intellectualizing that you were talking about earlier, the theory, within the category of keeping a tight rein on things and seeing things. I mean, it's a kind of epistemology versus that Dionysian orientation where there is no order and you surrender to your passions and you stop trying to make sense of things, but just respond at that emotional level. And there's a lot affiliated responses, I think. And it very much has to do with his intellectualizing, I guess, is what I was thinking about, like you were talking about earlier. That understanding things and keeping things at arm's length, that is his primary mode of artistic creativity that he's had throughout his life. That's also been a kind of denial for him, a kind of asceticism, and he's letting it go. But one of the differences, I think, where, because I agree with you, Mary, I think there are ways that we can desire and merge in a kind of way with beautiful things out in the world, and where we desire them, but not in a sort of lustful kind of way. But there's the other issue in this particular case, that this object of desire is another person and not just a painting or something like that.
Makes it tricky.
That's the thing that he never seems to consider, is that how is it?
Well, again, I think that goes back that this was written in 1911.
Very much aware of it. And I think he's aware that he's presenting this character in such a way that we can ask, you know, is he being remiss in treating Taggio that way? And we can be a little suspicious, even if man wasn't, we can be suspicious of Taggio's sort of beckoning glances and things like that.
At least say that he failed in his Socratic quest to Taggio as an idealized form, because for him, his desire was possessive and it was exclusionary. That was most clearly expressed.
That maybe that was something he was struggling with.
Yeah, the line about wanting everybody to die but him and Taggio, that, I mean, can't get more exclusionary. Exclusive.
I think in that line, the sentiment about him being left alone on the island with him, it wasn't so much like a naked hope as it was a possibility of their further getting closer together. Because as I was saying before, like, I mean, I think what's interesting about the story is how they kind of quite accidentally get closer and closer together. It's not at first that he's seeking him out. It's that they have, it's just happenstance, so much of it. I mean, he was even gone. He was even trying to get gone, but wanted to, you know, linger around and not be on their schedule, and so missed the thing and the trunk was sent off, and then, oh, what luck or whatever. That took me off to a side, because I was just thinking about this, the ascetic method that he took up in his life. And Cesare, I did find some quotes that can kind of connect, you know, because he talks about how he expressed the thought once that the beauty is done despite everything. It's like, in spite of being weak, I'm trying to find the line again now.
I think also to remember, I mean, there's a fair amount, I think, as far as him lying to himself in the book, as far as how many glances Tadjo returns to him. I think, you know, he was fantasizing about how he thinks Tadjo is getting closer to him as well by walking the same path through his beach chair every single day and so on and so on.
That's what I was going to bring up, actually, as a side point. Like, I think that calls into question that objectiveness, because there was enough of it throughout that I thought that there was something going on. Not that he was like leading this guy on, but certainly that he was making, especially in the opera, a connection. And they actually had a sincere moment where everybody was really into this one band playing, and the guy was like a real braggadocio and kind of like stuck his tongue out at everybody. And then him and the kid looked at each other and this, I'm not buying it. I see through this way. And they were the only two that had that moment together. So, I mean, they did actually share an intimacy, you know, there was other glances. There was, if you believe it, you know, the kid was kind of getting closer and would notice him and kind of knew that he had an admirer at a distance.
But did they? Can we be sure about that? Because it seems it kind of cries out for a Freudian reading to me. And we know that Bond read Freud. I don't know. You know, I mean, I kind of wonder, you know, like Laura was saying, I don't want to get too much into the biographical detail, but it's hard to ignore that this was written from a guy who had a similar experience and who would have been in the position of Aschenbach rather than Tadjo.
Yeah, but even so, Tadjo could still, he at least does say they shared a visual moment together.
That was one of the points where I really felt like, oh, he's looking back at himself. It was like, here he is at 14, and there's the troop there, and the I'm not buying it. That might have been a breaking point. Like, I'm not going to actually enjoy this. I'm not going to let myself go. I'm not going to fall into this, I'm making quotes, trap that everyone else is falling into with this false art, this art that's beneath us. So I found that an interesting moment. And I did think that they looked at each other and saw, we have this in common.
14-year-olds look around all the time at all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, but it's different, you know, to meet someone's eye across the room and have some sort of concurrence about something than just, oh, he looked at me. I didn't see that there was a place in here that actually indicated that he was fantasizing about his meetings kid with Tadjo. But it's interesting to call it into question because if the whole thing had been a fantasy, then what would that mean? I suppose that if that Tadjo might have at least, what, wasn't there a moment when they actually did they speak at one point?
I don't think they ever do.
No,
they
I don't think so.
Wasn't there a moment when they were in line for something or something and they were right next to each other?
He was speaking, but in his mind, I think. Remember when he left for the first time and he
left for the first time because it was driving him crazy. He didn't want to be in a position where he was confronted with this kind of beauty every day. Like he thought, oh, this is turning into a mania and I have to get out of here. Stop what looks like it's going to happen.
Tadjo's also Polish and probably can't even speak that language.
One thing, though, that I think we should remember that is selfish, I think, on the part of Aschenbach is that he comes across the information that something deadly is going on in Venice before Tadjo and his family do. And not only does he choose to stay and risk his own life, he risks Tadjo's life by not sharing that information with them. So he's so wrapped up in his desire, whatever kind of desire we want to call it, that seems to me a selfish decision.
It was interesting, though, because all of that is presaged by Tadjo being sickly. And he says at one point, like, he won't live long. So I thought that was interesting, too. Right. When it came down to it, he was being rather flippant about his sister's lives, but it looked like Tadjo was going to die soon anyway.
I found the line that I wanted to bring up. Just as far as, like, the death goes, you know, in Venice, I wonder, he does think explicitly about being the hero to the family and going up and saying, hey, guys, I've got an inside scoop. There's a plague. Get out of here. Save yourselves. And fancies that they would hug his neck and like he would, you know, be able to like even tussle Tajo's hair and, you know, be like, yeah, that's right, buckaroo. So yes, so if he doesn't say anything, but there might be the reason he doesn't say anything is that he's not certain of the threat. He certainly has his suspicions, but there is conspiracy in the newspaper and propaganda from the, you know, local communities, and they can't get a straight story, and people are saying it's thousands of bodies and others are just saying it's like 20. And so it might just be that he couldn't make a decision to be so bold on such a shaky premise. Even though
I don't know, Nate. It seemed like he made a very definite decision in the book. I don't remember the actual line, but it was like, nah.
He was enjoying making them lie to him as a game.
Yeah, yeah. Even before he was concretely told, he definitely knew. And it seemed like he ended up like joking by continually asking people, knowing what answer he'd get.
Yeah, and the scent of carbolic. Am I the only one who can smell this?
Yes. Okay. So I can see that. This is where I read things as being a kind of maybe a fantasy in his mind. This is where I thought he might be going a little nuts or losing the thread a bit. That maybe that the smell was around, or that was there really a conspiracy? You know, like one person and said no, that there wasn't. So this part was just a little weird for me. It was more foreboding. I wasn't sure if it was just thematic or if it was really going to play a central role, and you know, and there's going to be a deadly cloud of gas somewhere, like in that one story by Don DeLillo. So I mean, yeah, that makes sense that he would be certain about it. That makes it, that's a stronger decision on his part.
The only other thing I wanted to add is, again, how the book continually seems to repeat itself. I think in one of the first scenes, he imagines a jungle with a tiger and thick forest vines, and he describes a mephitic odor. And finally, when all this starts happening, that same mephitic odor comes about again.
That's weird that he's sort of stalked by this figure. And I wonder what you guys thought. That it seemed to me there's the commonality between the sort of reaper figure that he sees in the cemetery at the beginning of the novel, and then the rogue gondolier, and then later figures, I think, as well. It almost seemed after a while like he's being haunted by this same kind of creepy kind of figure who, you know, I almost, like I said, took to be kind of a reaper figure.
Yeah, the gondolier death rowing you on the River Styx, and you have to give him coins. And he goes, because he doesn't have anything small enough, he goes to get coins and bring back. And then the guy's disappeared. And the guy at the funeral parlor disappeared also. He couldn't see him anywhere. I just thought it was death haunting him.
Yeah, it's like he's a tourist in those first parts, you know?
He's walked into death and doesn't actually recognize what it is yet. There are a lot of gravestones. He talks about gravestones a lot in that opening. And then there's no one else on the boulevard, which was interesting too.
I mean, the way the first guy is actually described with his hat, his stick, and rucksack, I think I read, is associated with Hermes, the Greek god, who was also the guide to the underworld, who carries a broad-brimmed hat and a stick and rucksack.
That's the pilgrim character, I think, or the one that returned his stare and basically warned him from staring at him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It seemed that he was described similarly as the guy in the band at the end. There was something about the bald Adam's apple and maybe even long teeth, like strong white teeth, but it didn't make sense that was there. And so it just rang out that, like, well, this is the second time I've heard Adam's apple in a short story. So maybe it was just something you fixated on.
For me, the two questions that I keep coming back to that are hard in this story is, first of all, Laura's question. I mean, is there something about this desire that is, if it is desire, is there a way to handle it appropriately or inappropriately, or to see it, or, you know, to feel it appropriately and inappropriately? And if not, can it be that there's an intrinsically destructive character to this kind of desire that's also just intrinsically human, so that we can't, our relationship to beauty in this desirous kind of way is selfish and somewhat destructive, but it's also just something that it's a part of us, and we can repress it and ignore it, but we can't just get rid of it.
I think that that's a good way of putting it. I think that that's part of it.
There's this bit, and I think it ties in here. It's about his approach to art and the way he lived his life. It's this bit. Aschenbach had once given direct expression, though in an unobtrusive place, to the idea that almost everything conspicuously great is great in despite, has come into being in defiance of affliction and pain, poverty and destitution, bodily weakness, vice, passion, and 1,000 other obstructions. And that was more than observation. It was the fruit of experience. It was precisely the formula of his life and fame. It was the key to his work. What wonder then if it was also the fixed character, the outward gesture of his most individual figures? The new type of hero favored by Aschenbach had early been analyzed by a shrewd critic, the conception of an intellectual and virginal manliness, which clenches its teeth and stands in most defiance of the swords and spears that pierce its side. That was beautiful. It was spiritual. It was exact. Not merely passive, but a positive achievement and explicit triumph. And so, I mean, it makes me think about this.
Doesn't he talk about St. Sebastian right there?
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah. The figure of Sebastian is the most beautiful symbol, if not of art as a whole, yet certainly of art that we speak of here.
Sebastian's always been my fave.
So yeah, I just think there's something to this, maybe something heroic in his, I haven't tied it in, but there's a glimmer here that he's still continuing his project by not reaching out, and this kind of passive spiritual pursuit, because he doesn't just go up to the kid anyway, or there's a struggle going on here between being, you know, activated in his life in a way, or, you know, staying back and, you know, kind of just suffering it silently and just getting the hell out. And I think that there's something to him at the end, you know, dying on the shore, you know, as this kid looks back, seems to be waving him into the great beyond. I'm not sure what's there, but going back to, you know, how he lived his life and what he thought he was doing since he was young was building up to something and eschewing all of these pleasures. And it was his great achievement and triumph. And however, it also maybe bankrupted him and he was left wanting. And so given, you know, an objective desire, what do you do then? Do you abandon the whole project and go to chaos, or do you maybe stick with it? And that's heroic in its own aim. And maybe you had a small minor relationship at the end of it. This kid, maybe you had a thing with this kid, like psychically or something. I don't know.
When you're coming to the end of your rope and he's accomplished what he's set out to accomplish. He's been this artist who, through detachment and denial, has been able to observe and be critical. Because of that, he's been able to write greatly, but he's never lived. And so now he's coming to the end of his rope, and now or never. And he's already sort of tasted everything that he can from the sense of accomplishment and from the fruits of being detached. And like you say, faced with this object of desire, you know, even if it goes against everything he's been, what is there left to lose at this point?
Okay, on Daniel's note there, I want to read something about what Ochsenbach was going through. The image of the stricken and disordered city hovering wildly before his mind's eye inflamed him with hopes that were beyond comprehension, beyond reason, and full of monstrous sweetness. What, compared with such expectations, was that tender happiness of which he had briefly dreamed a few moments ago? This is one of my favorite lines coming up. What could art and virtue mean to him now, when he might reap the advantages of chaos? He said nothing and stayed on. That night he had a terrible dream, if dream is the right word for a bodily and mental experience, which did indeed overtake him during deepest sleep, in complete independence of his will, and with complete sensuous vividness, with no perception of himself as present and moving about in any space external to the events themselves. Rather, the scene of the events was his own soul, and they erupted into it from outside, violently defeating his resistance, profound intellectual resistance, as they passed through him and leaving his whole being, the culture of a lifetime, devastated and destroyed. And I just get a sense from that, and coming up for what Daniel was saying about him dying, about, yeah, he's reaching the end, not just bodily, you know, mentally, emotionally.
I just wonder if he succeeded in, a question I have is, what did he write on the beach in Taggio's presence? And did he succeed in fooling the public? I mean, he was found dead, slumped over in a chair, and the news of his death was announced. But did anyone put together the fact that he, you know, had makeup and dyed hair on? Did anyone find his notes, and what did they say? Or did he live and die as a respectful conservative author?
I was just looking at this line. Verily, it is well for the world that it sees only the beauty of the completed work and not its origins, nor the conditions whence it sprang, since knowledge of the artist's inspiration might often but confuse and alarm, and so prevent the full effect of its excellence.
Don't you think that with just about everything, no one wants to know how the sausage is made?
I was just thinking that, yes.
You have to think that you're in Chicago. because I always, you know, every once in a while I'll go and see an author read, and it just makes me crazy when I hear people ask that question, what's your process? I live, that's my process, you know, because the actual setting it down on the page, yes, I was fascinated to learn about how Roald Dahl wrote every day. But when it comes right down to it, I think that it is such an individual thing that maybe a lot of people who write, a lot of people who make art talk about the suffering of it, talk talk about what goes into it, blood, sweat, and tears, because it's hard. It's hard because it's always hard to expose yourself. And if you make art without exposing yourself, then it is sterile. And I don't think it can help to be but sterile if you don't put something of your soul into it. Again, going back to what I feel he was doing in this, was just going back and retracing and trying to find where he lost his art.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, you know, I forget how you put this, but no one should care how this sausage is made, but it seems that everyone cares how the sausage is made. You know, the question comes up all the time, and, you know, how people write things, what process they were under. And I think what it does is it just makes for easy answers, and it simplifies something that should be complex or is necessarily elusive and complex. And I mean, if we find out that, you know, oh, this book is just that time that man was on vacation and had some homoerotic desire for a child, okay, that answers that question.
Sort of like, you know, we want the fast food sausage, but then we also want the fast food explanation of how the sausage is made.
And then we want the lies. Because it has to be a lie, right? Can't really tell the truth about it, because I think that that's one of the mysteries, isn't it? It's one of life's great mysteries. Most of the time, some of the greatest artists who've ever lived talk about how they just channel work. You know, it just comes to me. They don't know.
Well, you're getting at this concept, I think, of sublimation, which is what I think of here. Like something in between this totally Apollonian and totally Dionysian response, where you're taking that passionate energy and making it conform to a kind of creative order and logic, and using that to create, you know, to make art. And it's performing a sort of purgation for you to some extent, but then it's also saving you from total annihilation in just the surrender to your passions in that destructive kind of way. And so it's a question for me, you know, how much of that is an answer that, I mean, it's an answer. How far does it get us? I mean, maybe that's sort of what Thomas Mann came up with, or in whatever way, you know, he's a writer, he's a creative person.
Just the last thing on art, I got a line. Even on a personal level, art is a form of heightened living. It gives greater pleasures. It consumes faster. It stamps the features of its servants with the signs of imaginary and spiritual adventures. And it produces, even in the most cloister-like atmosphere, a certain fastidiousness, an over-refinement, an exhaustion and curiosity of the nerves. In a way, even a life, the most outrageous passions and delights could scarcely affect it.
That's funny. When I read that line, I said, oh, this is one of my favorite lines. And I thought, oh, this is going to be everybody's favorite line.
One of the things that also goes on in this novel that we touched on a few times is, I was just thinking about timing, you know, because he's eating the overripe strawberries. It seems like, you know, I mean, I just come back to age again. I mean, there was a time when maybe these desires that he has, if they are a little bit illicit, maybe they wouldn't have been so inappropriate if he had done them when he was ripe, you know, when he was young, when he was a contemporary of someone like Taggio. But it's just that he feels them now at this point, you know, that makes them so inappropriate.
What was the line about he had a wife at one point, right?
Yeah, she died young.
Yeah,
he
had an appropriate wife. Wasn't that part of the...
Yeah, that or something about the daughter. Yeah, it seemed there was a weird phrase in there. Yeah, I'm not sure what it was, but that sounds familiar.
Yeah, I forget if she was aristocratic or, but you're right, if she was some sort of proper family.
And where he got his art from was his mother's side, which was the, you know, where he got his wildness.
Bohemian.
You know, yeah, came mm-hmm. from his mother's side. His father's side were the ones who shoulder to the grindstone kind of people. And his mother's side was seen as frivolous. And he was the product of that pairing.
You know, I wanted to ask, this plague, this disease that takes over Venice at this time, during this very, I guess, during the warm weather, warm waters, I got this image of this completely disgusting, falling apart little city. And we have touched on metaphorically that external manifestation of what was going on inside of him. But it's interesting to me to see that. Actually, one of my first thoughts when I read that about the city starting to collapse was, I was actually thinking about AIDS and its effect that it had in society. And I was looking at correlations. But on one level, I found it metaphorically very interesting. On another level, I found this very strategic tool that Thomas Mann put in to affect the death. Because we are all sort of talking about how he is dying internally, emotionally, mentally, psychologically during the course of this vacation. But I guess I was a little thrown when they brought in this plague that started gripping the city and wondering, did it jump out at anybody else? It just sort of happened in a very strategic way to sort of help affect a physical death versus the internal death that was taking place from the beginning of the story.
I kind of thought of it as, since I was reading it, that he was dead already. I thought, oh, you know, he's become fetid. He's starting to stink. He's starting to recognize now more that his own death, he's starting to actually recognize it. He's running around the city like a maniac. He's asking anyone who will speak with him. And then, you know, kind of officious banker finally breaks down and tells him. And that, I thought that was interesting. You could see him in a more professional light, but everyone else was kind of in on it. So it's
in on the fact of this plague.
Yeah. In on keeping it from him.
Right.
Different aspects of his psyche, where he had brought himself to, were saying, you're on vacation. You're not on vacation. You're in a coffin. You're in a graveyard. Right. You're inspecting your life and you're mourning the loss of your art.
Because he's achieved it. He supposedly has achieved very highly.
I'm talking about art, beauty, not the, I feel like he was saying that what he had achieved was professional success, but not beauty, that he had not gone in that direction, that he had become a...
He was like a successful TV writer, but he hadn't achieved the greatness of, say, a great poet.
Right. The beauty was lacking. He hadn't actually sought out and found and communicated beauty in its truth.
Okay. And so the plague, the disease in the town, in the city of Venice, is a physical metaphor for that.
I think so. For me, that was what it was for me. It was like, okay, so now he's actually becoming fetid. He's, you know, he's rotting away.
Well, one of the questions I had is, why is he being destroyed? I mean, if it's poetic as well as just a material thing, you know, that he's getting old and, you know, he just happens to be in...
He's only 53.
Right.
I mean, everybody's talking about how old this guy is, and I'm like, Jesus, he's only 53.
Well, he's relatively old, you know, as opposed to the youth in the novel. He's just a figure. But is it due to the material cause, you know, or is he facing destruction also because of his artistic choices, like Cesare has been saying? Like, is it because he's refrained from indulging in, you know, passion for his whole life? Is that something that he's being punished for now and that's why he's being destroyed? Or is it because he is finally indulging that he's being destroyed?
I think there's this divine nature to this beauty that he experiences. And it almost reminded me, I'm going to butcher the biblical reference, but I think it was Moses eventually had a chance to see God and died instantly or lost his sight.
Too close to the sun.
Yeah, finally being able to commune with this divine beauty destroys you. And of course, there's a temporal aspect. I mean, Taju is 14 years old and he's an old man. And I mean, we know necessarily that Taju can't retain the impact, whatever beauty he's emanating right now, into an old age. There's this temporal aspect to earthly beauty, but what he is supposed to have experienced is this otherworldly divine beauty. So I think it just doubles down on this temporality.
Yeah, and I mean, at the end of it, also, he knows that Tatsuo's leaving, and this is the last day, and I feel like he just gives up the ghost, you know, at that point. He doesn't, and I think that whenever he originally struck out, he maybe was worried about it. Maybe he wasn't seeking it. Maybe he thought he was coming back all along, but I don't know. I mean, you finally just get the sense that, like, he's never going back. No matter what he does, it's not like this is the end of it. And I'm guessing 53 was different in 1910.
It was. So, I know. It was a joke.
You know, there's definitely, I mean, he's definitely coming to the end of his rope, and the death in Venice around him, up to his death in Venice. I don't know if there's anything going on there historically. Again, like, that would change everything. You know, there could be something about tone or theme going on here, but if there really was diseases going around at the turn of the century, then it might just be a interesting coincidence or something. But I don't know why it would kill him exactly, and I'm not sure why he was so attracted or why this stuck out at him so much. But whenever he was on the ferryman, the gondola, the first time with the rogue gondolier, you know, he was like, I don't know where you're taking me. This isn't normal. I guess you could just club me on the back of the head and I'll just die here. And he was like, okay, well, fine, whatever. I'm just going to lay back. Like, You know, so there's a bit of resignedness going in. I'm not saying that he was suicidal the whole time, but, you know, I think that he was getting close to the end, and this maybe showed him the extent to which he'd come in his life by contrast. And at the end, and we should talk about the ending because there's probably something going on there. I mean, I just get this weird sense of something, you know, that he's this little beautiful boy is pinned down by his friend, and then he just sulks off into the ocean, and that's their last moment.
It was odd that it was pinned down, that he was pinned down. He was not the aggressor in that.
Well, no, because he's not an alpha male popular kid, right? He's just, he's feebly beautiful. He's sick. You know, it's also interesting that he has three sisters who are probably beautiful as well, but you wouldn't know it because they're in a nun frock, basically, right. By their mother.
He's feebly beautiful, but he's also incredibly attractive. I mean, the kids, his sulking off into the water that way was not, the kid tried to conquer him. The bully tried to conquer him and pushed his face and almost killed him, pushed his face into the sand and almost killed him. And then when he got up, he wouldn't let him apologize. So, you know, is that duty overtaking art? You know, your sense of propriety overtaking your more, taking over your sense of true beauty, taking it. So when he sulked off, that was it. Art was leaving. And he looked back over his shoulder coquettishly because there was something there. There was, you know, it had been there.
I felt like Tatsu lost his innocence a bit with the friend, that they were, everything was going fine, and then it went too far, and the friend was a dick in the moment, and...
And
immediately regretted it. As soon as he had done it, he was like, oh no, I shouldn't have done that to Tatsuo. Beautiful Tatsuo.
Right, but the thing was that Tatsuo was the little ringleader before that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, he was the apple of everyone's eye. And everybody, whenever he was walking off, was calling to them, and they knew that they'd gone too far. And so I feel like this is the crucial moment in his story in this, is that he, you know, despite being this beautiful figure, he was betrayed. And he makes everyone kind of suffer for it by leaving them.
That's what I thought. I mean, and art, right? So it's beauty is leaving. Beauty is taking its toys and going home.
But wait, sorry, I just want to mention that I'm not even sure if this is important now that I think of it, but Tatsu was the instigator in the fight, right? He threw sand in Yashu's eyes, at which point Yashu forced Tatsu to wrestle, a fight that quickly ended with the beautiful but weaker one's defeat.
Yashu was based on a real kid too, by the way.
I mean, for me, it almost seems like there's, you know, the double standard of the beautiful with the artistic.
Double standard?
Or there's different moral standard. I mean, Yashu ends up trying to apologize to Tatsu, even though Tatsu threw sand in his eyes.
Right, but Yashu almost killed him. There's playing and then there's almost killing.
14-year-olds.
It's the Polish custom that you can kill anyone who throws sand in your eyes.
Remind me never to go to the beach with you.
The highest insults in Poland.
That's it.
I don't know anything that we're on second thoughts.
I just wanted to find, because I think something we didn't talk about, and I don't even know how to connect it really, is the ever-present sea in this book. I mean, he sits in front of the beach every day and he talks about it at some point. I'm just trying to find a line that kind of described it.
The ever-present sea, you say?
Yeah, the ocean and the water as this symbol.
I was thinking River Styx the whole time, but I could be wrong.
He loved the ocean for important reasons, out of the desire for tranquility harbored by the hardworking artist who seeks to conceal himself from the multitude of possibilities by embracing the simple and immense, out of a forbidden proclivity for the unordered, the immeasurable, the eternal, the void that was made even more attractive by running counter to his work. To find peace in the presence of the faultless is the desire of the one who seeks excellence, and is not nothingness a form of perfection? I mean, the book ends with Tatsu walking out into the abyss, into the water, reaching out, at least in Gustav's mind, and Gustav dying.
Your point being the metaphor of the water for him.
Yeah, it's this symbolic, eternal thing. I don't know if it works to symbolize this switch into passionate Dionysian art that he makes, but I think it kind of played a beautiful role in the book, and especially the way the book ends. I mean, I just love that.
Well, there's this line here on 304 that says that only with the help of a bodily form is the soul then still able to exalt itself to a higher vision. So, A, obviously that elicits the whole Tatsuo beauty by the ocean and the water as well.
Cesare, when I was thinking about it, I kept coming back to Kafka on the Shore and that line about why do people love looking out at the ocean? And it's because there are no 7-Elevens out there. It's like, because it's that great expanse. There is something that's incredibly calming about looking out and being able to see a horizon, that mystery. I mean, that there's a bigger world than ours under the water.
Another one that this reminded me, of course, is what is it? Invisible Cities, which took place in Venice, right?
Yeah, all the cities are Venice.
Yeah, and the whole, I mean, when he was chasing or following Taggio around the city, I mean, it really reminded me of that book with the winding streets and Venice was death, Venice was life, Venice was beauty. It was eternal. It was all these things that kind of came up in more material, physical forms in that Invisible City book.
Yeah, especially whenever he said that anyone who did not come to Venice on a boat and see the shoreline, it would be like if you came by land to Venice, it would be like going into a palace by the back door. And I really like that.
I thought that was a great line. You know, that was a lovely idea that you have to see it the way that it's meant, the way that provides you the most beauty, that provides you the access to the true beauty of the place.
Well, are we arriving at closing and favorite lines?
I think so.
Yeah, there was this little bit I was looking at. We were talking about the ocean, and then there was this line that I'm still puzzling through it, but it was about the sun and how
sun
shines on things and makes everything the loveliest that it shines on. It basically objectifies the world for you. And then it is only through the medium of some corporeal being that it can raise itself again to contemplation of higher things after the sun's gone. So it's like the sun distracts us from our mental work or our, you know, thinking or our reasonable capacities. And then it goes on, love is like the mathematician who, in order to give children a knowledge of pure form, must do so in the language of pictures. So too, the God, in order to make visible the spirit, avails himself of the forms and colors of human youth, gilding it with all imaginable beauty that it may serve memory as a tool, the very sight of which then sets us afire with pain and longing. So I kind of got that it was this, that like you, your immediate impression of the world and all of its beauty is what hits you at youth. And that kind of serves as your compass or guidelines or baselines. And from there, you use that for the rest of your life. And it, the recollection of the way things could have been or whenever things were better is a source of pain. That's how I'm reading that. But it was interesting that like the sun, and as it shines on things, it brings the external world into your vision. And you've got to recognize that. And then whenever you have time to think about it, you can start putting those images and messing with them in your head and coming up with ideas and other forms that are imaginary. And so there's this kind of dual back and forth between seeing outside and then seeing inside.
So it's like we get the absolute in the mediated kind of way, but then if you want to go further, you have to sort of kick that ladder away to extrapolate the absolute from the particular that you experience.
Yeah, I guess, and then bring the ladder back and see if you can go up it or something, like, and see if it holds water, really. I mean, because I think that's what it gets into there with that bit at the end, you know, about it shows itself in human youth at first. And so that kind of gives you this, it serves a memory as a tool there. So it's this way of organizing the world and allowing you to, you know, understand, you know, beauty in these things. But as life goes on, the framework kind of changes and it becomes, instead, rather than a compass, some kind of hallmark.
Well, I'd pick that a passage that says very similar things. It's right at the beginning. He's talking about the difference between youth and old age or knowledge. He says, but it seems that a noble and active mind blunts itself against nothing so quickly as the sharp and bitter irritant of knowledge. And certain it is that the youth's constancy of purpose, no matter how painfully conscientious, was shallow beside the mature resolution of the master of his craft, who made a right about face, turned his back on the realm of knowledge and passed it by with an averted face, lest it lame his will or power of action, paralyze his feelings or passions, deprive any of these of their conviction or utility. But then he goes on and he says, you know, the master, he takes refuge in this amorality of form. And this was really one of the interesting themes that, you know, we talked about here, was this amorality of formalism and the idea that it's sort of that Platonic idea that then when you are contemplating that abstract essential form, you know, that absolute, you've left the realm of morality and you're now in this just total amoral place, you know, of contemplation, of direct contact with the essence of the thing, of beauty or whatever. And that was one of the troubling suggestions of this work and of philosophy against Platonism, that, you know, is there ever a place where you really do get to that strict observance of the thing itself, the essential thing, where no longer are you making judgment? You know, is the artist really amoral, you know, really recording the reality of the thing at that point? Or is he making judgments? Is he still, you know, in the realm of the moral?
Well, it seems like throughout this story that the appreciation of his beauty is the moral objective thing, even though we, you know, did say that they had like a connection and that kind of complicates things a little bit. But it seems like that is the kind of turn that this whole story takes place on, you know, this movement from a chaste intellectual life spare to one that kind of relishes beauty and the, and he does write, right? That's I don't think it's crucial, but it's very interesting, and it's gone over in just a paragraph. But he writes a bunch in this theme. I think you pointed that out, Cesari, that he maybe comes up with a masterpiece in this time, if we're being really generous. So that's interesting that maybe he was inspired. I don't think the story hangs its hat on that, like, you know, and look what the beauty of this child turned into, this amazing story that, you know, changed his fame and, you know, doubled it down. We don't get that, but it's interesting. I, at the end of it, I walked away with, I wondered that I was missing something, but I think that I understand this story a little bit better after having talked about it, or I feel pretty comfortable sitting in, I don't know, the idea or the feeling or the whatever, that this was some kind of platonic love after all. It was enough to maybe reach his spirit in a way, and that's really what was going on.
Did you feel bad or happy or upset with Gustav after all is said and done? Because for the first reading, it was for me like trying to suppress the impulse of being creeped out by this guy who, you know, has this orientation towards a 14-year-old that just screams out in today's morality that's just, you know, you don't even start with that. And then I read it quickly this morning and I just like felt really, I felt sympathy for Gustav.
You know, I didn't feel like so aligned with him. I kept looking for something else. I was surprised that he died. I didn't see that coming.
Yeah, I didn't see that coming along. Either.
I
mean,
I know.
It's called Death in Venice. How could you not see
that? Yeah, I know. I realized that afterwards. Like, Jesus Christ. Yeah. I didn't figure this out.
Writing's on the wall.
Yeah, really.
I thought it was the plague. I thought the plague was going to be a lot more of it. But yeah.
I think at the time it would have been more like influenza, right? Didn't influenza right around that time when he wrote it take out 500,000 people, 500 million people?
The Spanish flu did right after the First World War.
Okay. So he wrote this before that.
Yeah, I think it was cholera.
Oh, was it cholera? Okay.
That was one of the whisperings. That's what it could be.
Well, as far as sympathy though, Cesari, I felt a sympathy for him. I would agree with that, because I don't know. It's always a question for me, you know, in all of these sort of tragic stories or stories that have a tragic era, like where the agency is being swept along, you know, or being rowed along by a gondolier metaphorically, you know, the path of circumstance that leads you externally for sure. But I think there's reasons to believe that maybe it comes internally as well. And some of that, some of our internal weather, our internal motivation is also mysterious to us and is also beyond our control. And we are reacting to ourselves, you know, maybe as often or even more often as we're choosing to act. And so in that sense, I felt sympathy with him, because maybe his decisions weren't decisions that we would want to make, you know, if we were being conscientious, or we would want him to make. But I felt like I could understand him.
Yeah, I guess I saw the whole thing as a metaphor, so I never really... I mean, I did wonder about the following a young boy a bit. I never really saw... And because Tadzu's character was never developed, I always just saw him symbolically. I didn't ever... I never felt like he was in any kind of danger from Gustav. I think I was sympathetic to him throughout the entire reading. And then I listened to it. I listened to it also. That gave me a different feel for the book also.
Well, do we have last lines, or have we exhausted the reserves?
Cesari, how about you?
Goes first.
I was just going to read the way the book closes, because I think all mine were said. The onlooker sat there as he had when their eyes first met. His eyes had been trained on the stroller, his head leaning against the chair, but now his head rose to meet the glance and then sunk back onto his chest as if in a deep sleep. But to him it seemed as if that pale and lovely Hermes out there was smiling at him, beckoning him, as if he, taking his hand from his side, was pointing at and floating into that promising immensity. And as he was used to do, Aschenbach followed him. Several minutes passed before help arrived for him, who had fallen over sideways in his chair. He was carried to his room, and on the very same day, a respectfully shocked world received the news of his death.
I've got a couple here. I've got two. One is a paragraph, one is a sentence. And stop me if we've read this already. With astonishment, Aschenbach noticed that the boy was entirely beautiful. His countenance, pale and graceful, reserved, was surrounded by ringlets of honey-colored hair, and with its straight nose, its enchanting mouth, its expression of sweet and divine gravity, it recalled Greek sculpture of the noblest period. Yet despite the purest formal perfection, it had such unique personal charm that he who now contemplated it felt he had never beheld, in nature or in art, anything so consummately successful, which is, I guess, what started my confusion. And then the line I have here is, but in empty, unarticulated space, our mind loses its sense of time as well, and we enter the twilight of the immeasurable. And Cesare, he was saying that in discussion about the sea, the ocean, about being there.
Good connection.
Okay, mine is right before chapter 3. And you can stop me also because we might have read this already, talking about art. By art, one is more deeply satisfied and more rapidly used up. It engraves on the countenance of its servant the traces of imaginary and intellectual adventures. And even if he has outwardly existed in cloistral tranquility, it leads in the long run to over-fastidiousness, over-refinement, nervous fatigue, and overstimulation, such as can seldom result from a life full of the most extravagant passions and pleasures.
Yeah, it's nice. I think I read that one, but we must have different translations, and yours is much better. Yeah.
Well, I've got this last line, and I think that it captures this on-the-fence-ness that we've been talking about, to be creeped out or not to be creeped out. though I've told you where I fall, I just think this sets it up. Solitude gives birth to the original in us, to beauty unfamiliar and perilous, to poetry, but also it gives birth to the opposite, to the perverse, the illicit, the absurd.
That's a fitting ending, I think, because it's really a novel of tensions between opposites.